And welcome to episode 36 of the Clacks Women for Independence podcast. And I'd just like to say a little hello to an old friend of mine, Alan, in Aberdeen, who's just cottoned on to the fact that we have a podcast and sends us his best wishes for Clackmannanshire gaining its independence from the rest of Scotland. So not sure that we've perhaps been explicit enough in the description. I'll have a word with him. Music this week from Machinima. And again, royalty free, available on YouTube. And this piece was called The Hyperborean Menace, which I think's rather appropriate because we're going to be returning to the subject of Brexit and the end of the transition period. Now, it's clear that things are not going well in the negotiations, and my sympathies are absolutely with Monsieur Barnier, who... It's like the adult in the room having to negotiate with a group of four-year-olds who've spent the whole morning eating the Blue Smarties. And it's remarkable how he manages to keep his cool in press conferences when he's describing the horrors that face him across the table. So in our first clip, we have Monsieur Barnier explaining to the Tory government exactly what Boris Johnson, the leader of the Tory government, has signed up to in the political declaration and how it is incompatible with everything that the Tory government is currently demanding in the negotiations. So yet again, this really comes down to internal war in the Tory party. This entire Brexit disaster is due to the internal politics of the Tory party. And the rest of us stand around the edges looking on in horror. Michel Barnier sets it out yet again for grown-ups. What nonsense is being perpetrated here by the UK government?
We must stick to our commitments if we want to move forward. We engaged in this negotiation on the basis of a joint political declaration that clearly sets out the terms of our future partnership. This document is available in all languages, including English. It is not difficult to read, good written reading, if I may say. And this declaration was negotiated with Prime Minister Johnson himself. It was approved by the leaders of the 27 member states at the European Council in October 2019, it had the backing of the European Parliament also. It is for us, and it will remain for us, the only valid reference, the only relevant precedent in this negotiation, and it was agreed by both sides. Yet, round after round, our British counterparts seek to distance themselves from this common basis. Let me give you four concrete examples, referring precisely to the text of the political declaration. First, the Prime Minister Johnson agreed in paragraph 77 that, I quote, given our geographical proximity and economic interdependence, our future agreement must encompass robust commitments to prevent distortions of trade and unfair competitive advantages. This is what, together, we chose to call the level playing field. In this paragraph, the Prime Minister Boris Johnson agreed to uphold the common high standards applicable in the Union and the UK at the end of the transition period on these areas, stated competition, social and employment standards, environment, climate change, and relevant tax matters. We are today very far from this objective. Two, Prime Minister Johnson agreed in paragraph 66 on civil nuclear cooperation to maintain our existing high standards of nuclear safety. We are very far from this objective. Three, Prime Minister Boris Johnson agreed in paragraph 82 that our agreement should cover anti-money laundering and counter-terrorism financing. We are very far from this objective. Four, Prime Minister Johnson agreed in paragraph 118 to base our future relationship on an overarching institutional framework with links between specific areas of cooperation. And we are, once again, very far from this objective. In all areas, the UK continues to backtrack on the commitments it has undertaken in the political declaration, including on fisheries, where we committed to use our best endeavours to conclude and ratify a new agreement by the 1st of July 2020. It seems clear that we will not reach the target considering how the negotiations in this area are going for the moment. Even, ladies and gentlemen, in the rare areas where we saw some movement this week, such as the European Convention on Human Rights, we still fall short of what we had agreed in the political declaration. And finally, as a reminder, the UK since the beginning does not want to talk about our cooperation on foreign policy, development and defence at all, even though we agreed this with Boris Johnson in the political declaration. And to tell the truth on these points, defence and foreign policy, also as a former foreign affairs minister in my own country, I still don't understand why. We cannot and we will not accept this backtracking on the political declaration. On citizen rights, we continue to be extremely vigilant. There have been frequent exchanges of information between Vice President Barrosefcovic and the Minister Michael Gove on this topic. Regarding EU citizens residing in the UK, we are pleased to hear that 3.1 million EU citizens have already been granted residence status, and we are carefully monitoring the situation of more vulnerable citizens that have difficulties applying digitally. It is also important that EU citizens residing in the UK have access to social benefits in these difficult times. As for UK nationals residing in the Union, in the 13 member states that, like the UK, have chosen a constitutive system, we are working to ensure that procedures for applying for resident status are simple, easily accessible and clearly communicated. In the other 14 member states that have chosen a declaratory system, UK nationals will receive a physical document enabling them to prove their status. We also continue to be extremely vigilant with regard to the correct implementation of the protocol on Ireland and Northern Ireland. The UK Command Paper published on the 20th of May is useful. But there are still a lot of details to be settled if we want to move from aspiration to operation in line with the legal treaty. Furthermore, some of the objectives set out in this Command Paper, such as avoiding exit declarations on goods moving from Northern Ireland to Great Britain, are incompatible with the legal commitments accepted by the UK in the protocol. Thank you.
On the 3rd of June, Michael Russell was making a ministerial statement to the Scottish Parliament on the same topic. Here's what he had to say.
Thank you, Presiding Officer. Presiding Officer, in the referendum in June 2016, people in Scotland voted overwhelmingly to be part of the European Union. That preference has been reinforced in two subsequent UK general elections and in a European Parliament election. Yet on January the 31st this year, the Conservative UK government took Scotland out of the European Union. At the time, they said this was getting Brexit done, but of course, it is not done. All that has been agreed was the terms of withdrawal. Nothing has been agreed regarding the future relationship between the UK and the EU. Today, I want to update Parliament on the Scottish government's view of the current negotiations on that future relationship. And let me start by saying that we believe it is not and will not be possible to conduct and conclude these negotiations and implement the results within the truncated timescales set for them and within the context of an unprecedented global pandemic and a catastrophic economic recession, which may turn out to be the worst in 300 years. In our view, it is essential that the UK indicate that it will seek the extension of the transition period for up to 2 years, which is provided for in the withdrawal agreement. Refuse to seek that extension, which the EU have indicated would be readily granted, is a reckless act which will destroy thousands of jobs, undermine an already fragile economy, and devastate communities across Scotland at a time when we are most vulnerable. After the end of this month, it will not be possible to extend under the terms of the withdrawal agreement, and no other plausible route to an extension has been put forward. The deadline at the end of June is therefore real. Today, the Scottish Government publishes a new paper which sets out the consequences of refusing to seek such an extension. I shall outline its findings in a moment, but let me first describe to Parliament the highly unsatisfactory state of the current negotiations and unsatisfactory engagement with them. The original end date for these talks was set when the intention of the UK Government was to leave the EU at the end of March 2019. That period of 21 months looked very challenging even then. Of course, the UK did not leave the EU for another 10 months. So 21 months has become 11 months. And that time has been further truncated by the effects of the pandemic. So far, there have been only 3 weeks of negotiation, with a fourth round currently underway. The UK negotiating only published on the 27th of February. The draft UK legal texts on which the negotiations are meant to be based were only made available to the other EU nations 2 weeks ago. We had virtually no involvement in producing them, and indeed only saw the legal text with no possibility of changing them 24 hours before they were published. The Joint Ministerial Committee on European Negotiation is, by its agreed and written remit, meant to have oversight of these negotiations insofar as they affect devolved competences and I quote, to seek to agree the UK position. In fact, it has met only once since the discussion started in a virtual session on the 21st of May. It previously met in Cardiff on the 28th of January. The UK Paymaster General has conducted 3 sets of briefings with devolved ministers. Despite our efforts, that whole process isn't about influencing what is happening, still less deciding on crucial issues for which we are responsible. It is merely about hearing what is happening. But what is clear, even from these meetings, is that a no-deal outcome has become ever more likely. The negotiations are blocked on fundamental issues of governance, of level playing field and on fisheries, and in a way that no technical finessing will remedy. Indeed, to many in Brussels, it looks as if the UK is refusing to negotiate on such key matters. Resolution seems to be far off. The situation was not helped by an extraordinary letter from David Frost, the UK chief negotiator, to his counterpart Michel Barnier. We have long been opposed to the substance of the UK position, but the tone of this confrontational letter was an error of even greater proportions. I made it clear at the JMC that in using it, Mr. Frost did not speak for Scotland, and I do so again now. He certainly does not speak for Scotland in his desire to secure the most unambitious of trade deals, sometimes called a low deal, failing which he seems to be entirely prepared to accept a no deal. It will be no surprise to the Chamber that the Scottish Government believes that the best future for Scotland is to be an independent member of the EU. Others in this place differ, but that's not the point at issue today. The imminent danger lies in the failure of the UK to seek an extension, coupled with their drive towards a no-deal or low-deal outcome.
If you want to listen to the full speech by Michael Russell there, you'll get it in the Scottish Parliament archive. And there were a couple of revealing questions after the statement, right across the political spectrum. So we're going to listen to a couple of those now. First, coming from Murdo Fraser and Professor Tomkins of the Tory front bench.
My question to the Scottish Government is a simple one. Whose side are they on? Keep their hands off our fishing waters.
Michael Russell.
I'm fascinated, Presiding Officer, to see Murdo Fraser adopting what you might call the Cummings gambit in this, which is just to plough on regardless of what other people are thinking, and no matter the damage that is being done, even to your own cause. It is an extraordinary approach, but I suppose it's what one would expect from the Tories these days. I'll be very happy to answer the question about fishing. Strangely enough, I think the Secretary of State for Scotland was put up to ask me the same question at the JMC 2 weeks ago. And I'll give you the same answer. I'm on Scotland's side. I'm on the side of the Scottish fishermen who need a good deal. And they won't get a good deal from the blustering and positioning that the UK has put in. There needs to be genuine negotiation. But everybody who watches this knows there isn't genuine negotiation. As far as Mr. Fraser's other remarks are concerned, can I just say facts are chiels that one a ding? If he reads the paper, he will discover the facts of the matter. It'd be best he looks at those facts and thinks about them, rather than takes the knee-jerk Cummings position.
Adam Tomkins.
Say that the SNP are on the side of the European Union and not on the side of Scottish fishermen when it comes to fisheries.
I would think it's such a shame when I hear Professor Tomkins talking in those terms, because he knows that this is a foolish set of activities. And he also knows that the presentation he has just made is so far from the truth as to be risible. The reality of the situation is that we want to see if there's to be a settlement, a fair settlement. But we don't want to see Brexit in any case. I've never made any secret of that. Neither did Professor Tomkins. And indeed, nothing that has happened, not a single thing that has happened, has changed my mind, nor do I believe it has changed his mind. Unfortunately, what has changed his mind is the fact that the UK government are insisting on this foolish, foolish, disastrous course. We would be part of a level playing field and benefiting from the single market rather than throwing away the advantages that we have as a member of a single market. There is something deeply flawed in an argument which, when you see how bad it is going to be, how disastrous it's going to be, how damaging it's going to be for the city of Glasgow that Mr. Tomkins is in his region, all he can do is parrot the Tory line.
Thankfully, there was a great deal of consistency in the Parliament from the ranks of the other three parties. So just for completeness, here's what they had to say.
Alex Rowley.
Presiding Officer, as the Cabinet Secretary said, after the end of this month, it will not be possible to extend under the terms of the withdrawal agreement. I have read the paper that the Scottish Government published this morning, and I have to say that the analysis and likely impacts of a poor or no-deal Brexit can and will be devastating for Scottish businesses and Scottish jobs. And that is why Labour in this Parliament will join with all parties who want to put the interests of Scottish business and Scottish jobs before the interest of a Conservative elite in Downing Street. Scotland is on the brink of an economic crisis that will be devastating for families up and down Scotland. Now that the UK have left the European Union, it is crucial we get a deal that would give us access to European markets and close alignment with the customs union. That is why Scottish Labour supports the call for the negotiation period to be extended.
Patrick Harvey.
The Scottish Greens certainly agree that the extension to the transition period is very clearly necessary. And it comes as no surprise that the same people who brought us the profoundly dishonest and xenophobic Brexit campaign are the same individuals who have deliberately burned whatever little public trust the UK government had in the COVID crisis by saying clearly that the rules don't apply to them.
Willie Rennie.
Yesterday, I wrote to all party leaders inviting them to send a joint letter to the UK government to extend the Brexit negotiations. But I have been rejected by Jackson Carlo. He says the government can do two things at once. Yes, that's true. But Brexit is not some minor piece of legislation. It's the biggest change to our constitutional, political and economic framework in decades. It needs careful negotiation, and it is reckless to carry on in the middle of a global pandemic. If the leader of the Scottish Conservatives won't, will the Cabinet Secretary agree to a joint approach to the UK Government?
Now, obviously, I've curtailed a lot of the questions and answers for reason of time, and also to have a little bit of fun with some sound effects. But if you want to hear the full questions, the full answers, the full debate, it is available on the Scottish Parliament TV channel. And now we'll drop into the Clacks Wifey's virtual coffee shop and see what's getting our dander up this week.
So how is everybody then? Just same old kind of, isn't it?
I'm keeping my door shut and I'm doing everything. If I'm doing it, it's on my terms. I'm telling them, yeah, well, if you leave it, everything's going into quarantine for a week before I touch.
Yeah.
And some people are really understanding that and other people are completely blasé. It's unbelievable. It's the whole narrative that it's only people that are more vulnerable have to be careful. This transmits from person to person. So if everybody else is out there going, yee-haw, it's not going to affect us, this is fine, the virus is going to be forever, and about a third of the population are going to have to live in permanent lockdown. Now, what good is that going to do for the economy?
Even with a mask, yeah, nobody's going to come anywhere near me. I've met people that I know, like I met one of the teachers from Lawrence Hill. He was in Sainsbury's last Sunday. I'd gone very early to pick up stuff, as had everybody else. Everyone had the same idea, we'll all turn up at 9 o'clock. But I had my mask on, I was like, oh, hello. And he went, hi, how are you doing? I went, oh, do you know who it is? He went, yeah, I know who it is. So I'm like, even with a mask on.
My mum went out and she didn't have like a mask, so she had like a scarf. And it was at the weekend when it was really hot. And she'd put on these gloves because nobody was cleaning the baskets. And the wife behind her, she says, and the wife must have been at least 10 years older than me. But are you what? Are you cold, hen? And she's like, no. Is your hands cold?
I have to say, I spoke to my brother last night, and he lives in Carlisle. He actually said to me, he said, up until the Dominic Cumming things, I thought they were kind of doing an okay job. And I'm like, really? Really? You work in the NHS. Your wife works in the NHS. Her daughter works in the NHS. It was the Cummings thing that did it for them. But again, it's the information that because he's not going out looking for information. The poor show got barraged by me last night with wee Ginger Doug blogs and things like that to show him, you know, facts and figures that Boris standing up and saying, I'm proud of our record, right? So there's more deaths here than there is in 27 EU countries added together. And you're proud of that record? I don't know what information or lack of information or misinformation they're getting.
Saying that, I've had a lot more ticks on posts from my guys down south, who are normally Labour supporters, more supportive of Nicola. But
as you say, it's like, leave them alone. Don't interrupt your enemy while they're screwing up. They're doing that. It's us doing all the wee... subtle things like going and picking up your neighbour's prescription, dropping off a loaf of bread for them, checking in, asking how they're okay.
And I took on the tip of Murray, because when I'd done my Christmas cards, I'd left for some of them, but I'd soap tire on the back of them, so it showed very clearly it was made in Scotland. But for some of them, I've forgotten, so now I've stuck it on the front of the most recent cartoons I've been doing, so that it's very clearly made in Scotland. Yeah, so that would have been a suggestion by Mireille, was she'd taken a look at my cards and gone, where's the saltire?
Yes.
So it's the same
it's
principle.
It's very good.
It's those little tweaks that you do to just raise that awareness.
Somebody had shared with me yesterday that Jamie Oliver, and he managed to do a great job with a kind of school kind of food thing and the nutrition there. He's now started a petition about the food standard stuff and saying this is ridiculous. So as much as I didn't like the picture because it had union flags draped over, but if people down south are recognising this, well, yeah, there's lots of like sort of geographically protected foodstuffs down south, and they want to maintain that and the ability to use that recognition that it's a quality product.
But they're saying that's part of the trade deal is that not only must we accept the imports of their food, but we would not be able to compete by branding our own food as Scottish, or they get to also use the names of our food. Like you could be having Stornoway black pudding made in Texas, which is outrageous. Yeah. And that just destroys everything
we've
built up.
Which has already been a problem for the salmon industry, because they've been using stuff and branding it as coming from here when actually it's been fraud. It's not come from anywhere. It's not even sniffed the Scottish Loch. So they already have that problem underlying that. And then on top of it, you know, it then becomes not a problem because then it's not even illegal because you can call it something.
If it's an ingredient in ready meals or something, you're not going to know where it comes from anyway. And that's
One of my friends who's very apolitical. Oh, don't talk to me about politics. Don't you talk to me about Nicola. That sort of person. And she on Monday says, I want you all to sign the Jamie petition. And I went, you're too late. It's already been through Parliament. No, it's not. I went, it is. Oh, well, the time we get independence will not be come soon enough.
Ooh.
Okay. So there is different points for different folk.
Do you think this might be the turning point for Scottish farmers then?
Yeah, I think certainly the fishermen. I mean, we know a few fishermen up in kind of Skye, and there almost seems to be a kind of difference between the West Coast fishermen and the East Coast fishermen. I don't know why that was. Maybe the East Coast fishermen were more owned by the kind of the big five. But the West Coast ones were all like, no, we definitely don't want this, and we need to be independent, and you know.
But they need them for the people as well.
Yeah.
A lot of these people are EU nationals that are in fish and farming.
Yeah.
Lynn, you've been talking about Boris had not long earlier that day said, yeah, we want folk coming back. We want folk coming back to support our industries. And and it was just painful.
Yeah, I think was Neil not saying how he looks after old Alan in Edinburgh, and Alan's got like the young kind of carers that come in, both of whom are EU nationals. And what they're saying is, as soon as lockdown is cleared and people can travel, there's going to be a swathe of people going back to their country of origin because they're not happy being here. There was also a post somebody had done showing like had the UK, and they created this map. And they were saying areas of the UK that are empty, and they'd worked it out, you know, on the kind of density per kilometre squared, and yellow areas are empty. And basically Scotland, other than like say, Glasgow and Edinburgh, and there was a wee bit up in the Aberdeen, but other than that, Scotland was showing as empty.
I'd come back down to my parents' place in Gloucestershire, and my younger brother was there, and he was currently living in Oxford. I remember a conversation that they were having, and I overheard them refer to Scotland as a third world country. And so, of course, I stuck my oar in. But it was just that, you know, anything I said was then laughed off. Both those brothers have now changed their mind, but now one of them is actually living in France. The other one's now in London, but he's spent some time up here now because he came to stay with us. Their perspective certainly changed. But it just does kind of show you that dichotomy of, you know, unless people actively get out of their bubble and go and see elsewhere, it's a real struggle.
They think we're all walking about with kilts on, shouting freedom, offering people shortbread and having a wee dram of whiskey. That's
well also that is, it's also the, you know, the tight-fisted Scots. It's those stereotypes that come across, the fact that, you know, a Scot can't possibly be happy unless they're complaining. It's those kind of tropes that keep on being And within that, that kind of, well, you've brought your ill health upon yourselves kind of thing. There's this very, but we'll step back and...
The last group of people they feel comfortable about having that kind of discrimination against, because imagine in the 70s when that's the way they used to talk about black people or Jewish people or gay people, and now, you know, they're not allowed to say that about those groups, but for some reason they still feel they're able to say it about us.
To be fair, though, I do like to moan quite a wee bit.
But see, I mean, having lived a few places on this island, I don't think that's distinctive to Scots.
And that's it from us for this week. So thanks for listening, and we'll catch you all next time. Bye now.
And then like dogs.